Today at Reader's Corner, Mark Lynch, author of The Arab Uprising, The Unfinished Revolutions of the New Middle East.
What I've been seeing is this enormous wave of protests that have been sweeping the region. And what was surprising was not that you had people in the streets, it was that suddenly they were actually winning for the first time. There's a profound mismatch between the interests of Saudi Arabia and how the United States wants to approach the Arab Spring. And that is really at the heart of some of the contradictions in American foreign policy. We say that we want to spread democracy in the Middle East, and of course we believe it. But across the region, they've been watching us support dictators for 30 or 40 years, and they don't give us the benefit of the doubt.
A rebellion that started with a single person in Tunisia in January 2011 soon spread to encompass, in some measure, the entire Arab region. Called everything from an uprising to a revolution, the unprecedented events of the past year and a half have upended foreign policy and forever shattered the status quo. The successes, challenges, heartaches, and lessons learned from these events form the core of a new book by Middle East scholar and expert Mark Lynch, The Arab Uprising, The Unfinished Revolutions of the New Middle East. It offers a primer on the meaning of the uprisings, what they have accomplished, and how they have reshaped the region's power politics and norms. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mark Lynch. Since this interview first aired in June, protests and violence have continued to rock the Middle East, adding new relevance to Dr. Lynch's insights about the challenges facing this volatile and important region of the world. Dr. Lynch is an associate professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, where he is the director of the Institute for Middle East Studies. He is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security and edits the Middle East Channel for foreignpolicy.com. Dr. Lynch joined us by phone from Washington, D.C. for this interview. Mark Lynch, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So the title of the book, The Arab Uprising, you're the guy who coined the term that the media has used all over the place, the Arab Spring, and yet it didn't find its way to your title. What happened along the way?
Well, you know, I actually coined the Arab Spring term unintentionally. I didn't actually like it very much. So basically, that was just a blog post that I did on January 6th, where I was looking at what was happening in the region, and I wondered, it was the title of the blog post, is this Obama's Arab Spring? Looking back to 2005, when there was an earlier wave of protest around the region. And it just turned out, when people went back trying to identify who came up with the term, they found out that it was me, and I at first denied it. I said, that's impossible, no way. But they said, yep, that was you. But the reason I don't like it, and the reason that I chose the Arab Uprising instead, is that the concept of the Arab Spring makes it sound, to many people, like what happened was this sort of explosion out of nowhere, that the Arab region was sleeping, it was quiet, it was totally repressed, and then suddenly, out of nowhere, you have these protest movements appearing. And that's actually not at all what I've been experiencing studying the Middle East over the last decade, because what I've been seeing is this enormous wave of protest that had been sweeping the region for almost a decade. And what was surprising about January of 2011 was not that you had people in the streets, it was that suddenly they were actually winning for the first time. And so it's a slightly different sense of what's going on there, not an explosion out of nowhere in the Arab Spring sense, but suddenly this reckless sense of the possibility of victory.
So what accounts for their winning this particular time?
You know, it's interesting because I think that what happened in Tunisia was pretty much unique to Tunisia. You know, that was one of those, they call them the black swan events, right?
Right.
Where nobody could really predict that was going to happen. But once you saw the success in Tunisia, I think what that did is that inspired a lot of ordinary people who were not dedicated activists, not the ordinary types of people who went out into the streets before, people who were unhappy with their regimes, but not really keen on going out and getting beaten up and arrested and tortured and all the things that happened to political activists. After Tunisia, suddenly those ordinary people suddenly were willing to go out and join the protests. So if you look at a place like Egypt, you had had the same 10 or 15,000 people protesting for something like a decade. what happens on January 25th is suddenly hundreds of thousands of people come out and join them. And that, I think, overwhelms the security forces. It overwhelms the regime. And I think that explains a lot of what made this different.
And how was the word spread? Because in the, let's call them the old days for a minute, what happened in Tunisia wasn't going to get over to Libya real fast, or Egypt, or wherever, Bahrain. But it did in this case.
And that's exactly right. That's a key thing, is that, you know, these protests broke out in an environment which was increasingly linked together by new media technologies, by satellite television, especially the Qatari TV station Al Jazeera. And at least for urbanized youth, the internet, Facebook, Twitter, things like that. And what's interesting about it is it's not just that the news got out. It was that the news was framed in a very particular way. So when things happened in Tunisia, people in Yemen or in Jordan, they didn't look at this and say, wow, that's interesting what they're doing. Instead, what happened is they saw it as part of their own struggle. Like, they did it. They're just like us. We can do it, too. And so when you saw the big protests, say, in Iran back in 2009, you didn't have that sense of shared identity. People didn't see it as part of their own struggle. But in the Arab Spring or the Arab Uprising, they really did. And that's the way it was presented in the media. That's the way the activists talked about it. And there was this sense that all of these popular movements were engaged in a single common struggle.
Again, in days of old, the authoritarian states relied on near-total public conformity, and I guess they did that with this strong network of intelligence and policing. How come that breaks down in the Arab Spring?
Well, it breaks down, but only partially. So I would say that one thing which broke down almost completely, and I actually believe it's extremely important that it did, was the ability of the states to control information and to control the images and to control the flow of opinion. And this is across almost the entire region. You know, it used to be that in places like Jordan or Syria, you couldn't make fun of the king or the president in public. I mean, that would simply get you thrown in jail. And now there's widespread mockery of leaders, even in the supposedly stable regimes where you haven't seen massive uprisings. There's just widespread public discussion in a very critical and mocking way. But at the same time, we don't want to go too far, because for almost all of these regimes and almost all of these countries, the repressive force didn't just disappear. It was still there. And so in a place like Egypt, for example, even after the fall of Hosni Mubarak, the last 15 months has been this extremely tense political showdown and political battle between largely unreconstructed security forces, including the army and the intelligence services, against the various political forces which came out of the revolution. And then if you go to a place like Syria or Bahrain, you can see that some of these regimes are more than able and more than willing to use really violent, bloody force to stay in power.
And of course, as Americans are watching all of this unfold, the first reaction is cheering for democracy. Isn't this wonderful? People are getting their lives back. They're going to take control of their lives. They're going to throw out the despots. But then as the days go on, actually more than days, weeks and months, we see there's a role, an increasing role of Islamists involved in these uprisings. Help us understand that from the standpoint of whether or not that's good or bad for the movement in terms of American foreign policy, for one thing.
Well, I think that part of this goes back to what I was saying before about the role that these kind of very small, non-representative activist groups played in sparking the revolutions. But, you know, say you have 10,000 people who are doing the sorts of things I was talking about. Once you get to democratic elections in a country like Egypt, say, where you have, you know, 45 or 50 million eligible voters, they're not going to be the dominant electoral force. They can control the streets, maybe, but not the ballot box. And if you go back and you look over the last 20, 30 years, in most Arab countries, it's been the Islamic movements which have been increasingly dominant in the political culture, in politics, in the streets. And so it shouldn't surprise anybody that once you shift from revolution to the ballot box, that Islamist movements are going to do well. Is this good for the United States? It really depends, I suppose, on whether you think democracy is good for the United States. I mean, I guess the way that I would talk about this is that in the short term, it's going to make things a lot more complicated for the United States. I mean, the new Egyptian government, whoever it is going to be much less cooperative than the old government was. But at the same time, I actually believe that having more democratic societies is going to make them more stable. It's going to make it more moderate over the long term. So these Islamist groups, which used to be able to get away with spouting all kinds of nonsense, once they're actually governing, it's going to become much harder to do that. And you look around the world and look at how democracies work, and it's usually ugly and contentious and kind of annoying. But over the long haul, it seems to be the best kind of government. I think Turkey is a good example here. You know, Turkey's become much more democratic in the last 10, 20 years. It's got an Islamist prime minister. It is really annoying to the United States in many ways with its positions on Israel and on some parts of the Middle East. And yet, it's become one of our strongest and closest friends in the region, despite the fact that it has all of these kind of difficult tendencies.
And as you address in the end of your book, it also forces the United States to look at some of its policies that really aren't what you might call pro-democracy.
It's going to have to. I mean, and that's one of the things which is the most difficult for Washington to do, because we have very deeply ingrained habits of how we operate in the Middle East. And so what you often hear in Washington is people paying lip service to respecting Arab public opinion, listening more, engagement. But then what they want to do is force everything back into the same old policies. And I just don't think that's going to work over the long term.
Now, the Obama administration had to play this one very carefully. Walk us through how Obama looks at this issue by the time it gets to Libya especially, and whether or not we should go in, or at least the UN should go in, and weighing the role of the U.S., which is not exactly the most popular figure over in the Middle East these days.
Basically, I would say that, you know, the Obama administration gets a lot of grief from both sides, from Arab activist types and people who really support the uprisings. They see Obama as constantly being slow and leading from behind and things like that. And then for people who are deeply invested in the status quo, they see him as far too willing to accept political change and to abandon old allies like Hosni Mubarak. I actually think that that he's done quite a good job in terms of trying to manage, on the one hand, a really sincere and deep belief that these changes are in the long-term interest of the United States, with a healthy and honest appreciation of what American interests in the region are. So it's been a really tough balancing act, as you say. I think that the key moment for me early on was when the Egyptian revolution broke out in January 25th. It took 6 days from the outbreak of the uprisings to Obama calling on Hosni Mubarak to step down. And this reflected his recognition very quickly that Mubarak simply couldn't survive. You know, the United States didn't start this, and the United States probably couldn't have stopped it, even if it had wanted to. But I think that another president might have stuck with Mubarak a lot longer. And I don't think it would have worked, but I think that the instinct would have been to retreat back to the status quo. But I think Obama saw very quickly that this was unstoppable and that it was a good thing. But he also recognized really early on how unpopular we were. I mean, he knew that the people in Tahrir, the last thing in the world they wanted was American leadership. Right? They didn't want the United States jumping up on a platform and saying, this is all about us. So he was willing to try to work from the background and work from the sidelines, not get a lot of credit for it, but actually do quite a bit of good in terms of pushing the revolution, getting Mubarak out, and trying to get to a transition.
You're listening to Mark Lynch. He's the author of The Arab Uprising, The Unfinished Revolutions of the New Middle East. In your blog, and I might let our listeners know that you do have a blog that's part of foreignpolicy.com. The blog is called Abu Aardvark. In it, you say, in one of your most recent postings, you quote Nathan Brown, one of your colleagues, I guess, an analyst in the Middle East. Egypt has performed the stupidest transition in history. So maybe you could just bring us up to date on where Egypt stands today in terms of following through on the so-called uprising.
You know, if you look at Egypt, it's really quite sad because in some ways, at almost every step where there's been a decision to be made by almost any political actor, they've made the wrong decision. I mean, it's really been mind-boggling to see. So the activists, very quickly on, they became disenchanted with the transition, and they decided that they were going to largely avoid electoral politics and stay in the streets. And what we've seen for the activists over the last year is ever smaller protests as the masses don't, you know, they're sick of them. They don't want to come out in the streets anymore, and increasingly violent. And back in December, I don't know if you remember this, but there were some really horrible images of the Egyptian military tear gassing and shooting activists, which was, you know, the opposite of what we saw back during the revolution. The military leadership has been extremely short-sighted and done a very, very poor job of communicating with the Egyptian people. And so there's a lot of mistrust of what the military is doing, and a lot of people believe that they're manipulating events and trying to prevent any kind of real democracy. And then the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamist movement, early on, they promised that they would not try and dominate the new political scene, even if they could. They promised very clearly not to field a presidential candidate. And nevertheless, they broke every one of the promises. They fielded a presidential candidate. They won a dominant position in the parliament. And so basically what you have now is enormous amounts of mistrust and political instability. And we're on the brink of a presidential election between a representative of the old regime and someone from the Muslim Brotherhood, without even a constitution having been written. So nobody even knows what the powers of the new president are going to be. So it's been kind of a case study in squandered opportunities thus far. But at the same time, I'm still optimistic about Egypt. I just have to be. I've been traveling to Egypt since 1991, and I just have enormous respect for what Egyptians can achieve, and I think they're going to pull it out.
Bahrain has gone almost unnoticed in all of this due to media blackouts and other tactics. What's the latest there?
Bahrain, unfortunately, is one that I don't think is going to work its way out. I've been extremely critical of the Bahraini government. Most people have forgotten this or maybe didn't know it, but at the peak of the Arab Spring back in like February, more than half of the citizen population of the country was in the streets protesting. I mean, some people have claimed that this is the largest per capita protest movement in the history of the world, which wouldn't surprise me. I mean, it's not a very big country, but still, half the country's population, that's a lot of people. When they cracked down in March, they cleared the streets, they bulldozed the central protest site, and then they began this systematic campaign of repression, often on sectarian religious grounds. And what they've done is they've basically seeded alienation, hatred, frustration across the entire country. And I think Bahrain is someplace which is going to be very unstable in the coming years.
And what's the role of Saudi Arabia when it comes to Bahrain? Because, of course, they're backed by the Saudis, aren't they?
And Saudi Arabia basically was the driving force behind that crackdown. They basically decided that they were not going to accept political change in Bahrain, and they sent sent troops across the bridge, which connects the two countries. And I think in Bahrain and more broadly, there's a sense that the Saudis are using their money and their other resources to try and push back against political change across the region, trying to prop up fellow monarchies and trying to do various things to limit the amount of change in the region. Now, I think a lot of people in the Middle East tend to exaggerate how effective the Saudis are at doing this, but this is really shaping the politics of the region right now. And you can see it even in Syria, where Saudi Arabia and Qatar have been taking a really lead role in trying to promote the Syrian opposition and try and push for some kind of international intervention in that civil war.
And I want to talk about that in a minute, but before we leave this issue of Bahrain and the Saudis, it does seem to me that this takes us back again to the conclusion in your book when you're pointing out to us that America just has to face the fact that we're on the wrong side. And when it comes to the Saudis, it's like, how does America cheer the uprisings in Tunisia and Libya and Egypt and then sit alongside these guys in Saudi Arabia who still haven't learned how to treat women and who are so backward in what we think are the democratic ways of life? And yet we know why it's all happening. It's called oil. Help us out with what a second Obama administration or a Romney administration does in a situation like that.
Well, you know, I don't think you need help. I think you put your finger right on it, which is precisely that there's a profound mismatch between the interests of Saudi Arabia, which is one of our primary allies in the region, and how the United States wants to approach the Arab Spring. And that kind of unrecognized or unresolved tension, I think, is really at the heart of some of the contradictions in American foreign policy. I think that one of the things which really explains this, it's not just the oil, although the oil is extremely important, it's also Iran. The United States, of course, is very, very concerned about the possibility of Iran getting a nuclear weapon. And Saudi Arabia is pivotal in trying to help assemble and take a leading role in the regional and international coalition trying to contain Iranian influence. And so in a case like Bahrain or in any question of political change in the Gulf, that's I think, a very important consideration in Washington and around the rest of the world, is the combination of needing to keep the oil flowing but also needing Saudi help in containing Iran. And this is kind of what I was saying before, is that that does put us in pretty deep tension with our hopes elsewhere of promoting serious change.
You're listening to Mark Lynch. He's the author of The Arab Uprising, The Unfinished Revolutions of the New Middle East. You mentioned Syria. Secretary Clinton has stated her case, calling for the need, perhaps, for some kind of tough international action, but also saying that it's going to require support from the world community and Syria's ally, Russia. Now, by the time we air this little discussion you and I are having, some things may have already fallen in place, but I wonder if you could comment on what you think is going to happen. The Syrian situation is deteriorating rapidly, as you know. Where's it going from here?
I'm very, very worried about Syria, and I think that the deterioration there is rapid, and it's getting extremely violent and ugly, and we've seen no sign whatsoever that the Assad regime is willing to do anything serious to try and begin a political transition. And I honestly don't see any stable solution to Syria, you know, now or in the years to come, in which Assad remains in power. But that said, I'm fundamentally and deeply opposed to any kind of military intervention there. I think that you look at Syria and your heart bleeds. You want to do something to help the Syrian people. I want to do something to help the Syrian people. But getting involved there militarily, I fear, would be a disaster, because the kind of like cheap, easy things which people say we could do, airstrikes or safe zones, that sort of thing, aren't likely to tip the balance. That just gets us embroiled in a war which could stretch out for a very long time. And if we want to end it, we very well might have to then contemplate putting troops on the ground, and then we're right back into a new Iraq. And that's a place I really don't want to be. A lot of people say, and what I think is going to happen, unfortunately, is I think you're going to see a move towards arming the Syrian opposition. And I suspect that this is probably going to lead to a long-running insurgency and civil war in Syria, not to a rapid overthrow of the Assad regime. And even if it does lead to a rapid overthrow, which I don't think it will, but even if it did, nobody has the slightest idea of what's going to replace the Assad regime. And people are very worried about reprisals against the Christian community or the Alawi community, about the role of Islamists, the role of Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups. There's just a lot of things that can go badly wrong. The military escalation, I think, is just going to embroil the United States in something that it doesn't really need to be embroiled in.
Excuse me for going back to the basics, but describe the opposition for us in Syria, who these folks are.
Well, you know, that's not just going back to the basics. That's a fundamental problem, is that the opposition in Syria is really an unknown quantity. It's extremely disorganized and fragmented. There's a number of different competing organizations, both in exile and inside the country. If you say you're going to start arming the opposition, well, then the obvious next question is, well, which opposition? Who exactly are you going to give the weapons to? And when you have multiple organizations, each claiming to represent the opposition, none of them able to command majority support, to say nothing of universal support, inside of Syria, it's just a recipe for disaster.
You note in your book that Americans underestimate how little credibility the U.S. has on the question of Arab democracy, and somewhere toward the conclusion of your book, you at least allude to the issue of the two-state solution as far as Palestine is concerned. Could you comment on to what extent that will remain as the fundamental last issue to be dealt with, or maybe first issue to be dealt with, after this upcoming election in November? Will not somebody have to figure out how to make the United States more credible as a player in the Middle East working with Netanyahu? And I find it interesting, by the way, that foreignpolicy.com has a long article about Netanyahu on it. And Netanyahu has emerged as a significant political leader who isn't going to be pushed around.
Yeah, I mean, and there's two separate questions that are kind of related here. The one first on credibility is that, you know, Americans, I think, generally do tend to take their own rhetoric or their intentions at face value. We say that we want to spread democracy in the Middle East, and we know that we're good people, so of course we believe it. But across the region, they've been watching us support dictators for 30 or 40 years, and they don't give us the benefit of the doubt. And so when we say we want to liberate the Iraqi people, people look at that and they say, well, really what you want is the oil. Or really, you know, in other words, there's always this very, very deep skepticism about American intentions. And that, I think, is not going to change quickly. I mean, you know what they say about credibility, a reputation. You know, you can spend a decade building it up and you destroy it in 10 seconds. Once you've lost it, it's very difficult to get back. We've been doing the opposite. We've been destroying our reputation for 30 years, and how are you going to get it back in what's, in world historical terms, the last 15 months is the blink of an eye. On the Israeli-Palestinian stuff, I mean, the fact is that I see very little prospect for any movement on that anytime soon. I've never been less optimistic that there's going to be a resolution in the near term. And I know that the president really cares about this issue and, you know, probably will try and figure out some way to try and push it again. But I'm just very, very skeptical about it. It's not just that Netanyahu as a person is difficult to deal with or some things that you often hear. It's that, broadly speaking, in Israel right now, that position has widespread support. It's a popular position. There's just not a real sense in Israel right now that negotiating a two-state solution is either necessary or desirable. And without that, it doesn't really matter who the prime minister is, because that's kind of where the public is. And I'm not really sure what the United States can do about that. But if we don't do anything about it, then that does have that constant corrosive effect on our reputation and credibility in the region. And that's kind of built into where we are right now.
Mark, we've run out of time, but I can't tell you how much I enjoyed your book. You've performed a valuable service in helping us understand the complex issues facing the Middle East, the U.S., and the globe, for that matter. Thanks for joining us today on Reader's Corner. And again, the name of the book, The Arab Uprising, The Unfinished Revolutions of the New Middle East. And don't forget to visit Abu Aardvark. Did I get that right, Mark?
That's correct.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Next week, CNN's national security analyst Peter Bergen, author of Manhunt, The 10-Year Search for Bin Laden, From 9/11 to Abbottabad. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.